Good evening.
Good evening.
Is that tinsel?
Yeah.
Haven't seen tinsel in a long time. I wanted to continue talking about breathing tonight. Every so often I go through a period where I really want to talk about the subtleties and the art of Zazen in detail. And we have been studying the Fukanza Zengi of Dogen, although I thought tonight there's this wonderful book called What the Buddha's Life Retold by a guy named Robert Allen Mitchell. It's basically got all the essential teachings of Buddhism in it, taught by the Buddha. Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, the precepts, and just everything is in there. And I thought, well, maybe we should study that. It's in Zen places. They study all this derivative esoteric stuff, but actually, do people really know what the Buddha taught? For a long time, the Buddha's words were out of print. I thought that was interesting. During the Alan Watts era, when Alan Watts' books were selling millions, the Buddha's words were out of print. They're back now, but so we might start studying that. But the four stations of mindfulness, including mindfulness of breathing. So I wanted to start, actually, since most of you were here last week when I talked about breathing, if you had any questions or issues or comments that had come up for you since then. So sort of start with questions and then pick up the thread from there. Yeah.
It seems so simple, but I've been practicing with just my breathing awareness more than anything else. And what I realized, which probably is a known condition, but when I receive the in-breath, I don't take it, I don't move it, but I simply wait for it and receive it. There's a kind of openness, a physical openness in my body to taking it in. It's like I make space for it. And then the exhalation is just letting the breath go away. And, you know, that seems very basic and simple, which it is, but I realize that I often return to actively breathing in, to making an effort. And there's a consciousness and there's a physical action out of it instead of waiting for the breath to come, which is a totally different sensation. So it's been interesting.
Well, that's true. I think I mentioned last week that unlike yoga, you know, yoga breathing or pranayama, which is the practice of prana. Prana is the inner breath or the energy of energetic flow of life. And prana is actually a term used extensively in Buddhism. But our breathing is not pranayama, it's mindfulness, which is quite different. Awareness, so in the formula of the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutra, it says, oh, now I breathe a short breath, now I breathe a long breath, now I breathe a short in-breath, now I breathe a long out-breath. In other words, whatever it is, you simply note it. You don't try to do anything about it. But since the point of Buddhist practice is liberation from karmic patterns, the actual point or purpose of awareness of breathing is to open your awareness outside of habitual patterns. So that's what I was going to move to tonight, but I wanted to make sure I covered anything that might have come up from last week. I know not everybody was here last week, but you can ask a question even though you weren't here. That's fine. Everybody breathes, so I know you have some experience. Nothing? Okay, well, maybe something will occur to you. You can interrupt me anytime. The main topic of Zazen is the mind. in all of its senses in which we say that, the thinking mind, the essence of mind, Buddha mind, because the mind is the place that karma happens. It's the place that suffering is produced. It's also the place that liberation happens and that compassion is produced. So the mind is the main game. So I said last week that I took note that Dogen never mentions breathing, which seems odd at first. Why wouldn't he mention something that, first of all, is so central and that people like Suzuki Roshi talked about constantly? that's one of those many questions. I wish Suzuki Roshi were here. You know, I could ask him and he would give me an answer. It's a little like that scene in Annie Hall, the Woody Allen movie, where somebody, they're in a movie line, and somebody's rattling on about Buckminster Fuller, and Woody Allen character is saying, this guy knows nothing about Buckminster Fuller. This guy's an idiot. And he goes over and gets Buckminster Fuller. He gets him to come. He's somehow there magically. And he says, would you talk to this guy? And Buckminster Fuller goes over and says, sir, you have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. You have no idea what my work is. That was great. You know, it's our fantasy. So I wish Suzuki Roshi would hear. He could answer such a question, but he's not. It's up to me. And my surmise is that instruction in mindfulness of the breath and regulating the breath was elementary instruction for monks and not something that Dogen committed to paper. But that's an important point because a lot of people think that Zen practice is just following or counting your breaths forever. And that's true up to a point. But remember, calmness is not the goal of our practice. Liberation from karma is the goal of our practice. And the reason for that is simply that calmness is temporary. Calmness is a condition like any other condition. And if calmness is your goal, probably a judicious prescription for Ativan would be much more effective. But just like meditation, Ativan is temporary. And when it wears off, you're anxious again. It doesn't do anything for the roots of your anxiety. It's good medicine. And when I was ill with my brain infection, I needed such medicines and I was very grateful for them, but they didn't, you know, I could tell when they wore off. There's no question. So, what do I mean by karma or karmic mind? There are basically three tonalities of the mind that are important in Zazen. One would be karmic thinking. And karmic thinking is like worry. Worry would be a good example of karmic thinking. You go over something again and again, and your thoughts are driven one after the other in a circular way by the topic of the worry. And when you're sitting, the symptom of karmic thinking is that you're somewhere else. You're not in the room, you're not in your body, you're not in your senses. You're involved in the spinning of distraction or daydreaming or worry. And there are all sorts of flavors to karmic thinking. It's not all bad. You know, sometimes karmic thinking can be a wonderful daydream of some fantastic thing that you want, very pleasurable. a lot of people come to meditation, particularly in the early days, a lot of people came to meditation because they thought it was just as good as drugs, but without the side effects and the cost. And Grace Shearson tells a wonderful story. She tells it over and over again about she and her sister going to have Zazen instruction from Suzuki Roshi, and what they'd heard is this Zen guy had a way of meditating so you could get high without drugs, and they thought, this is great, I can, you know, be high all the time. So they went and they got the Zazen instruction. He spoke very slowly, and then at the end, he spoke even more slowly. He could pick up on people very quickly. You know, he said, the more you do this practice, and they thought, yeah, yeah, the more you will know that life is suffering. And they thought, ooh, and they couldn't wait to get out of there. That just was horrible, you know. And, it's funny, Grace became a practitioner and, you know, then a Zen teacher, and her sister didn't. Although she was talking to her sister not too long ago, and her sister, you know, who's now in her 60s, said, Grace, you know that funny guy we went to see in Japantown back in the 60s? I think he was right. <You know? laughs> It's hard for the people in their 20s to really understand what it means, you know, about dukkha. Much easier to talk to people our age. You don't have to convince them, you know. You really don't. Anyway, karmic thinking is... a lot of people spend a lot of their time in Zazen and karmic thinking, and I wouldn't call it, in a technical sense, you wouldn't call it Zazen, although in an absolute sense, it is. I won't digress too much into that arena, but karmic thinking is, I think, all too familiar, and it's basically the default state of most people. Most people are... most people walking down the street are, from the standpoint of a Buddhist a calm mind, quite out of it, simply totally engaged in their karmic life, very little awareness of their surroundings or anything else, very rigid and repetitive and fixed in their beliefs and their experience and in their understanding. This is why... we suffer. This is the cause of suffering, basically, second noble truth, that state of mind. So we can fall into it at any time, whether we're beginners or advanced practitioners. We all have the potential for karmic thinking. The second kind of thinking, which a Zen teacher, contemporary Zen teacher named Uchiyama Roshi used to talk to a lot, is... I don't really have a good term for it. I forget his term, but basically it's non-karmic thinking. In other words, thoughts come, but they're not strung together and they're not bound by a powerful karmic force. They just come up and they disappear and they come up and disappear. And that's a sign of your mind is starting to get focused. And many people think that thinking is thinking, and that karmic thinking and maybe I should call it random thinking. Karmic thinking and random thinking are the same thing. They're not. Random thinking is really not a problem. And in random thinking, your awareness, as Karen, as you said, you have a clear awareness of the in-breath and the out-breath and the pause where you are aware of your body and the in-breath and the out-breath and the pause. But then there's this overlay of random thinking that comes and goes. But it's not so compelling. It's thin because it isn't strung together by powerful karma. So it's kind of thin, it's transparent. And you can maintain your awareness of body while the random thinking comes and goes. the third state is where there's not much thinking at all, which technically we would call samadhi. And samadhi is a fruit of a lot of practice in Zazen. And Dogen in Fukan Sasenki and other works basically is talking about samadhi when he describes, in fact he calls it samadhi, he has various terms. He calls it the self-joyous samadhi, and it's that's how he defines and characterizes actual Zazen, is it's a state of samadhi and clarity. So it is definitely the case that you don't always need to think, that you can, particularly in session, you can arrive at a state where for long periods of time there's hardly any thinking at all. Never, but you're quite awake, you're quite present, you're quite centered, and your physical awareness and breath awareness is very clear and continuous. It's one of the main reasons we sit session, is because we want to move from karmic thinking through the various stages of random thinking to true samadhi. And and from the stability of samadhi, there can be real shifts in what you identify as yourself. So samadhi is the gateway to awakening. So where does the breath come in? Well, in the early days, Suzuki Roshi taught counting the breath a lot. And counting the breath is also taught as one of the many types of concentration in the Tibetan system. But most people don't find counting a very inspiring practice. And it took me a long time to figure out that counting in Japanese is a very different affair than counting in English, because all numbers in from 1 to 10 in Japanese end in the syllable u. So hitotsu is 1, futatsu is 2. So you can see how what a good meditation aid it would be, because every as you exhale, hitotsu, futatsu. So really the u, it was almost mantric, very effective. And in English, you know, with our short Anglo-Saxon numbers, 1, 2, 3, you know, it doesn't have anything like that spacious quality of Japanese numbers. So I have a little booklet that I've written. It's online on our website called Zazen Basics, or Zen Basics, and it has an essay in there about counting the breath. I also have an essay which I haven't taught in a long time, where you simply use the syllable hu or u as a an aid to focusing on the breath, because that is the sound in Chinese medicine of the stomach. Then qigong, that's the stomach sound. If you study qigong, certain kinds of qigong, you'll discover the Chinese have a sound syllable for every organ. So the lungs are and the stomach is ooh, and you do these things, and so it puts the energy in your stomach, and that's where your breath is as it's going out. So whether it's an actual ooh feeling or you just have that subtle sense of the sigh, the out-breath, and the feeling of it, and the kind of the subtlety of it. That is the epicenter of the focus on the breath. And the point I'm making is that whenever, rather than treating breath practice as a separate practice from pure awareness, these days I'm feeling that we should, particularly as we get more and more experience with Zazen, we should use concentrated attention on the breath whenever we feel, whenever we realize that we are engaged in karmic thinking. In other words, to restore your stability, at least to the point where the thinking breaks up into random thinking. The image I have is like today it was overcast. The whole sky was overcast, and so that's like karmic thinking. It's completely clouded. You can't see the sky at all. All you can see are the clouds of your fantasies. But as the storm begins to break up, the clouds separate, and you can see the sky, and there are little individual clouds that float around. That's like random thinking, you know. And the sky is like your breath. The sky is continuously available, and there's random thinking going on. So you can at least use awareness of the breath to break up the seamlessness, it's a little awkward, of karmic thinking to the point where it's random thinking and you begin to have some stability and you can stay with the breath. In the old days, Suzuki Roshi used to say, if your mind is distracted, count your breathing from 1 to 10 until it clears up. And he used to tell us that the main reason he taught breath counting is so we would understand how utterly distracted we were. Because when you're very distracted, you can't count past 1 in many cases. And some people, you know, made it into an Olympic event, and they told themselves, if I have one thought while I'm counting my breath, I'm going to go back until I can count from 1 to 10 perfectly. This is a little non-Buddhist, to say the least, but it fits our American sense of competitiveness. You know, it's me against my thoughts. And some people could get very good at it. I did. You know, I was, like everybody, I was young and competitive, and I wanted to do it right. And so, you know, the problem is that kind of practice veers into the kind of practice the Buddha rejected in his early spiritual life, because you can go into that level of concentration called the jhanas, the eight jhanas, to such an extent that you're almost in a coma. You're so concentrated, you're not even aware of the outside world. And, you know, even in the recent past, there were yogins in India that they tested who could slow their heartbeat down, only have it beat a couple times a minute, and could do all these amazing things. You can do a lot of things with concentration. Does it make you a good person? Does it allow you to fulfill the bodhisattva vow and be available for suffering beings? Maybe, maybe not. In a lot of cases, it just makes you arrogant, like any, makes you like the Tiger Woods of meditation, you know, you think you're exempt from all the rules. So as a character building exercise, that kind of intense concentration isn't necessarily gonna help. You know, if you're a competitive, striving, A-type person, is just going to enhance your image of yourself, and you know, just you'll have to undo more karma. You finally wake up to the fact that your teacher points out to you that it's your ego doing the whole thing to get its needs met. The notion that you use the breath as the constant center of your practice enough so that you can keep karmic thinking from overwhelming you, then your practice can proceed. When it's stormy weather, in other words, when karmic thinking overwhelms you, you really aren't, your practice is not really moving. It's just spinning in the same place. If you have some clarity, even though it's partial clarity, and again, as I said last time, the word stability is probably more apt than concentration. We're not looking for the degree of concentration that excludes every thought and where you can remain single-mindedly attentive to one object for hours on end. if you want to do that, fine. A lot of the old Buddhist monks who lived in monasteries and had nothing to do all day but meditate did that. became very powerful. There's a great bizarre and rather gruesome Zen story that comes to mind. The old master died, and there were two main disciples. And people wondered who was going to. The master didn't name a successor, so it was up to the assembly of the monks to decide who was the one. And so they got in front of everybody, they got into a Dharma dialogue. And Monk A said something, and Monk B said, "I don't think you understand our master's teaching." And Monk A said, "Nonsense, of course I do. I'll show you," whatever. He said, "See this stick of incense? I'll put it in here, and if I don't die by the end of this incense, you can kick me out of the monastery. And he gets up in his very powerful samadhi, and before the incense is burnt, he keels over dead. I think this story is a little exaggerated, but anyway, this is the story, right? And Monk B comes up and says, "You may have been able to do that, but you really don't understand our master's teaching," you know. So, you know, the actual story, probably he didn't die, but he did something that demonstrated his immense powers of concentration. And the other monk, you know, the monk who really had wisdom, said, you know, what's the old phrase? That'll get you, I don't know, there used to be a haircut and a cup of coffee or something. I don't know what there's a phrase like that. I mean, concentration by itself, what's it really good for in the end? What's really important is the kind of person you are and what you do in your life. That's what's important. And if Zazen is not a way to develop and to transform yourself so that you can act in an awakened manner and act according to the Buddhist way of life, then it's not good for much. So it's very important to understand why we're doing all of this. It's not just it's certainly not to get high, believe me. I think we all learned pretty quickly that was a mistake. You know, as I said last week, the purpose of Zazen is not to be calm or to be high or to be in a special state of mind. It's to be real. And what that means is to be present with what's actually going on in a way that you're ready to turn it to awakening when the moment is right. So it's not just being present. That's too passive. Lots of people teach be here now and be in the present moment and all that. That's fine. But a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva vow is not to be present. The bodhisattva vow is to be active and to be skillful. So, you know, if you're walking down the street and some homeless guy comes up, you know, and shakes his cup at you, it's not enough to be present and say, "Oh, I see here very clearly, but there's a homeless guy shaking a cup at me." That's good, and then you walk on. So that's not really enough. But if you walk up to him and put some money in the cup and look at him and say, "Hi, what's your name?" This happened in Berkeley a couple weeks ago. There's a guy, he was just wasted. I mean, he was shaking, and you look into his eyes and it was like this endless pool of sorrow. And I said, "Here's something for you. What's your name?" He said, "Adam." I said, "Hi, Adam. Hope you do all right today." And then I walked on. I mean, you know, that's all I could do. But if I wasn't prepared to meet him, then I, you know, what's the point of putting money in his cup? You know, he's just going to probably drink with it. But maybe that helped, that somebody cared about him enough to ask his name, and he could barely say it. It was sad. It really was. Multiply that by a couple of billion and you've got reality. That's what I said, you know, Zazen is to be real. So, you know, to have the stability to understand that those are the facts, and the heart, the compassion to stay in the middle of it and do whatever you can when the opportunity presents itself. That's the point of Zazen. And how does sitting still and following your breath and trying to break through karmic thinking help you do that? Well, that's the question, isn't it? That's the trick. It does help, because I said, it's the first thing I said, the mind is the center of everything. Everything that we do. It's the first verse in the Dhammapada, and I can't remember it. We should study the Dhammapada too. It's very beautiful, the verses of the Dhammapada, which is part of the Pali Canon. But it's something like, the mind is like an ox. The cart follows the ox, like your actions follow your thoughts. So thoughts are the origin of everything. Bad thought leads to bad action. Good thought leads to good action. Being aware of your thoughts is the first step to knowing the difference between a bad one and a good one, you know. Until you can get them into view and you can stop them and you can have some clarity around them, you don't realize how powerful thought is. It's like a nuclear bomb. The image I used to use, I still use, is the old, it's getting so hard to use these old analogies because they're, you know, the analogy was to an LP record with a needle, which nobody, it's like ancient, it's like Paleolithic times now. But, you know, when I was a kid, I had an old record of Beethoven's Fifth, you know, and sometimes I like to play around by putting the needle on the record before I turn the volume up. And so, because I could hear a little tiny da-da-da-da, you know, inside that, you can just hear it on the record. It's loud enough that it's a big orchestra. Da-da-da-da. That's like a thought, you know. Da-da-da-da. It seems very, very quiet and faint. But if you turn up the volume, you know, it's huge. It's a whole orchestra. That's the power of the thought. That's the power of karma, you know. A thought, the nuclear atomic bomb is a thought. Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt, you know, in the early days of World War II. I'm sitting here looking at Ed, whose father was part of the Manhattan Project. So this is part of your life story, right? Einstein wrote that letter to Roosevelt, and he said, I'm very worried that the Germans will weaponize atomic power. And in fact, they were well down the road to doing that, as we've discovered. Came very close, actually. And so he was a pacifist, and it must have broken his heart to write that letter, but he felt he had to do it, and so the U.S. government started. That's how the Manhattan Project started, right?
Mm-hmm.
We decided we had to build a bomb before the Germans. What the British did, I'm digressing, but you know, it's a wonderful story. What the British did, there was a heavy water plant in Norway that was intrinsic to the Nazis' plans to get a bomb, and the British commandos went repeatedly into the snow on suicide missions to take out that plant, and they took them four teams to do it. First three were all killed. And now we live in the atomic age. So I'll stop there on that wonderfully pleasant note. But I am pointing out that, you know, what I say about Beethoven's Fifth is how it is. You know, a thought seems very subtle and quiet until it's tied to an amplifier, which could be millions of screaming people, you know, see. Lou Hartman, who died recently, in 95, Lou was in broadcasting, and he was in Germany in 1936 in those crowds.
Mm.
And I said, what was that like, Lou? He said, you have no idea. You have no idea. There's 500,000 people, and you cannot not do it. The power is so strong. And he's saying, you know, of course, he didn't want to not do it because they arrest him, so he did it. But it's also that the power just sweeps you up, and And he was a lefty. I mean, he was a communist, and he was blacklisted from American radio in the 50s. So, you know, this was the furthest thing from his belief system. But he was there as a correspondent or something when he was young. And his hand went up, along with the rest of them. The power was unbelievable. So, it all comes from the mind. And the power of the Bodhisattva vow is just as powerful. It goes both ways. It's powerful in both directions.
When you talk about zazen, it's useful for me to discriminate the difference between a byproduct and a purpose. So if I'm getting you right, I prefer to think of the concentration or the clarity or the transparency as a byproduct of sitting still, as opposed to going in to sit with a purpose. If I go to sit to achieve clarity, I feel like I'm warping the, I'm putting like a magnetic field on reality. If I just sit zazen, I notice these things have happened over a number of years, and it makes it feel less volitional.
Well, I would use the adjective egoistic. In other words, the ego is endlessly clever and will try to co-opt anything that you do, including zazen. Mm. This is the whole power of the story of Mara and Buddha. You know, Mara, who really was Buddha, actually, you know, Mara, and each of us have our Mara, you know, is what you're talking about, wanted to own the Buddha's spiritual achievements. And so ego wants to own everything that you do in zazen, and it'll always make you an offer you can't refuse. So, yeah, it's very helpful to always remember that we don't really sit for ourselves at all, really. We sit mm-hmm. for everything, for everyone. We sit just to express Buddha. And so that's how I would put it. You know, concentration is a little bit more than a byproduct, because without concentration, you can't break up the clouds. Concentration is kind of a tool to break up the clouds of karma. And so it's kind of like a hoe, you know. You can't break up the crust of the dirt unless you kind of, you know, hack at it and then it loosens up, kind of feeling. So,
but if concentration of the kind that you're talking about pre-existed zazen, you wouldn't have to sit zazen to do it. You could just apply it.
Well, no, you have to cultivate it.
Yeah, okay.
You have to cultivate it, and that's why you can't just sit once, the way Paul Reps thought. Yeah, do it once, you'll get it. No problem. Mm-hmm. That was the conceit of the 50s, you know. Read one line from a koan and it would all happen. Yeah, that's what we thought. That's what they thought, to be poets and so forth, you know. Sometimes I feel like Buddhism in the West is an endless succession of misunderstandings and what's the word I want?
Arrogance?
Not arrogance exactly, but, you know, getting it wrong. I mean, so many of the early books on Buddhism were just flat wrong. You know, it wasn't until people like Suzuki Roshi and other real teachers came and you could see the vivid presence that made it all non-intellectual that you could see, oh, now I get it. You know, Dogen's impossible to read, impossible, and he wants it to be that way. He's like James Joyce of Buddhism, you know, Finnegan's Wake. But when Suzuki Roshi talked about it, it just, you just look at him and you could, he says he understood it, it was very simple to him, and you thought, well, he gets it, I guess I can get it too. That's why it's so important to have a real person, you know. And several people in our Sangha knew him, and it's one of the powers of our little Sangha, is that, you know, we carry around that feeling of confidence. Even people that only met him slightly, you know, you feel like you ran across the real McCoy, and it's enough nourishment for a lifetime.
It's a question so much, but can't help but experience the changes that Zazen meditation, Zazen, kind of brings into life, and yet the contradiction that I experience, you know, when I get up from the cushion, live my everyday life, the expectations and the shifts that happen within my way of thinking on a daily basis will sometimes create a level of conflict because, for example, I mean, one thing about Zazen I notice in the practice is, you know, I know when that karmic mind is, you know, the record, the broken record is playing. When it's not, it's, you know, that acceptance of what is, which sometimes when somebody comes to me, a client, and they're saying, or anybody, saying, well, you know, you've got to be definitive. You've got to tell me exactly how this is supposed to go, and blah, blah, blah. Or they might say something like, well, this is what I want. I want you to do this. Oh, okay. So if I'm in that level of acceptance, I will say, oh, okay, sure. Or you want me to make a decision, okay, I will make a decision. Only later to find out that that decision or that level of acceptance was not what was ultimately wanted. So there's this dichotomy, this kind of, how does it apply kind of question that I have. Because it almost creates, it's helping to create further conflict.
Well, it's not a dichotomy, it's a development. And the development is, it sort of starts with unawareness, that's before you have any experience of practice, to awareness, to skillfulness. Mm. Skillfulness is way more complicated than awareness. And, you know, the word for awareness, well, let me just go back and give you the technical terms. The word for unawareness is avidya, which means usually translated ignorance, but literally it means avidya, unconscious, unaware. Avidya means aware. So avidya is the root of karma, ignorance. That's the teaching. Awareness is prajna, you know. Wisdom. Skillfulness is upaya. And upaya is prajna mixed together with a whole life. You know, prajna is easier than upaya. And You know, you can have prajna. There's a lot of stories about this in Zen and in Buddhism. You can have a lot of prajna, not much upaya, which is, I think, what you mean by the conflict, you know. And so this is, upaya is the core skill of the bodhisattva, not prajna. Prajna is kind of an inner thing, something you, it's part of your inner life. Upaya is how you interact with the universe. And it's really hard. And prajna is beyond most people. Upaya is, we're going to need the next 1,000 years to figure out. I mean, really, I'm not just joking around. We're going to need 1,000 years to figure out how to create an upaya that fits the modern world. There were no people in the Buddhist time that did anything like your kind of work. Not even close. You know, they had artisans, they had farmers, that was pretty much it. They had warriors. You know, it was very, very simple. So upaya is the challenge of Buddhism in the modern age. I think that Buddhism has kept enough of itself alive to offer us prajna in people like Suzuki Roshi and Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and other great teachers. They've been able to convey the feeling of prajna. But I don't think Suzuki Roshi would have any better sense of how to do your work than you. In fact, he was a pretty spacey guy and not really very practical. He made a lot of mistakes. So, you know, I mean, for example, when he was young, he was supposed to go to he was supposed to carry some important things to a funeral. And it was critical that he get there on time, and he missed the train stop. He was daydreaming. He talked about that story over and over again. I mean, how long do you think he'd last in the workplace? Mm-hmm. You know, not very long. So does that make sense to you as a kind of a challenge?
Yeah.
You know, avidya, prajna, upaya. Upaya, don't feel so sorry for yourself, but this is hard. This is really hard for everybody, even awakened people, even the Dalai Lama. I mean, Dalai Lama is spent his whole life, every ounce of energy he has, to try to apply upaya to the Chinese. And most of the Tibetans who live in Tibet feel that he's failed, that he's totally out of touch with, you were just there. And you saw what it was like there. It was awful, right? Terrible. And a lot of young people there think, what's the Dalai Lama done for us? Look at our situation here, it's horrible. I talked to a young Lama, the one who's in Richmond. What's his name? It was very sad. He said, he's about 40. He said, yeah, we should stop soon. In my part of Tibet, the Chinese will not let us speak our language. They will not let us have our culture. They will not let us have our religion. And then he kind of smiled and he said, everything changes. My culture is dying. And there's nothing I can do. All the upaya in the world has not been enough to help to make that right. So this is what we struggle with, everybody. This is what we struggle with.
They all talk that way.
Huh?
They all talk that way.
Tibet, in Tibet?
They're all, the suffering is right up front.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have the sensation that in your work life, you feel like you're failing constantly, well, I would say that's actually an insight of prajna. That's an insight. I wouldn't shortchange yourself on that point. That's very, very good starting ground for upaya. You know, you can't develop more skill unless you feel I could do better. You know, that's where upaya really starts, you know. And Suzuki Roshi used to talk about that all the time, you know. So I hope that helps.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, even...
I've been thinking a lot about that.
Even a little, you know, it's not that easy.
What's your work?
Web.
He's a high-tech guy.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a very cutthroat...
Deadlines.
...world. Yeah. Okay, let's do our refuges. Thank you. Thanks for obliging me by going a little over.